is nowhere.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is part two of the intelligence agency episodes that Jason and I have done. This is hour one of episode 640. We left off with Russia last time. We're going to pick up with the Weimar Republic, and that is roughly 1919, 1920. The intelligence agencies are a massive deal in this world because, for my money, they are behind so much of what's going on as we are drifting towards, I don't know, social ratings and an ID to get online and databases that know more about us than we know about ourselves. Anyhow, welcome, Jason. Anything you want to add before we jump in here?
Well, in a lot of countries throughout history and still to this day, intelligence agencies are unregulated agencies that kind of do whatever the heck they want behind the guise of serving a government.
For my money, Jason, when you go review that Eisenhower clip where he's warning everybody about the military-industrial complex, to me, this is what he was talking about. To me, you're looking at places like the CIA, maybe even the FBI at this point. These agencies that seem to get massive funding no matter what the conditions in the world are. And as we know, they seem to run under the radar and with no oversight at all. And with everything that's happened in the news lately, we're beginning to realize that these agencies have blackmailed everybody to control them. But with that, I guess let's jump in here.
The Weimar Republic was established in 1919 after Germany's defeat in World War I. However, it faced severe challenges, with the Treaty of Versailles restricting its army to 100,000 troops, banning conscription, and imposing massive reparations. It also faced domestic unrest from communist uprisings and right-wing pushes, such as the 1920 Kapp Putsch, which threatened stability. The Abwehr emerged within the Reichswehr's Ministry of Defense to address these external and internal threats, replacing the defunct intelligence sections of the former Imperial Army. Unlike the Soviet Cheka of 1917, which prioritized ideological repression, the Abwehr focused on military intelligence, monitoring French occupation forces in the Rhineland, Polish ambitions in Silesia, and Soviet military developments. They operated under strict secrecy to evade Allied oversight and sought to rebuild Germany's strategic capabilities in a hostile Europe, where France and Britain remained wary of German resurgence. Its early leaders, such as Colonel Erich Gempp, emphasized discreet intelligence gathering to circumvent Versailles restrictions. The Abwehr's operations in the 1920s were constrained but innovative, reflecting Weimar's need to maximize their rather limited resources. Based in Berlin, it employed a small staff of officers and civilian agents, including former soldiers, diplomats, and expatriates, to collect intelligence through open-source analysis, border surveillance, and covert networks. By maintaining a low profile, it avoided Allied crackdowns and preserved Germany's intelligence capabilities for the soon-to-come Nazi era, when Admiral Wilhelm Canaris would expand it into a global espionage network after 1933.
So I had never realized what a massive deal World War I is until I read Rudolf Steiner's books, and some of the people that spoke in the forewords made comments about what he thought of it. Are we looking at the beginning of the modern idea of a surveillance state where maybe they don't have all the technology, but the planning's coming into place? Kind of like in the Winter Soldier movie from Marvel, where they're informing you this dude back in the 30s, Jason just said 1933, invented these algorithms that taught us how to read the 21st century like a book. Are we looking at the beginning of surveillance in the semi-modern era? For my money, and this is my point of view based on what I've read, being woken up to the fact that I didn't know a lot about World War I, and it doesn't seem to be a prevalent thing when we go to school, not like World War II. Are we looking at another event that was forced to happen? Is that whole, this dude got assassinated, just more of the media we see now? And I suspect that it is. What do you think about it, Jason? Do you have any view of World War I? When I went through school, it was like an offhand mention.
To me, World War I is the end of the old world, at least as far as the West is concerned. As far as school is concerned, they definitely made a much bigger deal about World War II than World War I in any of the history classes I took.
When I look back at some of the tech that's even prior to this, like the air pressure tech from the so-called Victorian age and other things, I can't be convinced that there weren't airships everywhere. I just can't be. And I know darn well the whole Hindenburg thing is like a 9/11 event, starting to scrub that out. For some reason, when we went through school, they tried to kind of shuffle World War I down. They acted like it was significant, but we didn't learn a lot about it. I don't know. Do you think what I think? Do you think that whole assassination that supposedly started the whole thing was another play by media?
That whole event never sat quite right with me, and I've always been suspicious of it.
Whatever the truth may be, we know certainly that this is where the chess pieces really start to move, and we're not talking about one country either.
In 1933, Adolf Hitler rises to power, and the now Nazi Germany establishes two key intelligence and security organizations. The first one is the Gestapo, or Secret State Police, and the second one is the SD, or Security Service. Both are intended to consolidate the regime's control through internal security and foreign espionage. These agencies, operating under the broader Nazi apparatus led by Heinrich Himmler, targeted political enemies, dissidents, and Jews, enforcing the regime's totalitarian ideology with ruthless efficiency. The ascent of the Nazi Party in January of 1933 had transformed Germany into a one-party dictatorship, which completely dismantled the Weimar Republic's fragile democracy. The Nazi Party faced opposition from communists, socialists, trade unionists, and other political factions, and so they sought to eliminate all dissent and enforce their extreme racial policies. The Gestapo, which was formally established in April of 1933 under Hermann Göring in Prussia and later centralized under Heinrich Himmler, was tasked with rooting out internal enemies through surveillance, arrests, and interrogation. The SD, which was created in 1931 by Reinhard Heydrich but would be expanded in 1933 as the SS's intelligence branch, complemented the Gestapo by gathering intelligence on political and ideological threats, both within Germany and abroad. Unlike the Weimar Abwehr's military focus in the 1920s, these agencies prioritized ideological conformity, targeting Jews, Romani, and others deemed undesirable, alongside political foes, which reflected the Nazis' fusion of security with racial persecution. The Gestapo's operations in 1933 were marked by brutal efficiency, leveraging a network of informants, police, and civilian denunciations to monitor and suppress opposition. They were headquartered in Berlin and conducted mass arrests following the Reichstag fire in February of 1933, which they blamed on communists and used to justify the suspension of civil liberties via the Reichstag fire decree. Thousands, including social democrats and trade unionists, were detained in early concentration camps like Dachau. The Gestapo used interrogation, often involving torture, to extract confessions and identify networks, which created a climate of fear that stifled dissent. By 1933, it began targeting Jews, enforcing discriminatory laws and monitoring Jewish communities, which was laying the groundwork for the Holocaust. The SD, under Heydrich's meticulous leadership, operated as a more sophisticated intelligence arm, blending domestic surveillance with foreign espionage. In 1933, it infiltrated churches, political groups, and universities, compiling detailed files on potential enemies, including liberals and Freemasons. Abroad, SD agents in Austria and Czechoslovakia gathered intelligence on anti-Nazi exiles and monitored border regions for subversive activities. The SD also collaborated with the Gestapo, sharing data to coordinate arrests and developed early cryptographic capabilities to intercept communications. By 1933, the SD's focus on Jews included tracking emigration and economic activities, foreshadowing its role in the Final Solution. The impact of the Gestapo and SD in 1933 was immediate and profound, cementing Nazi control by dismantling opposition and instilling widespread fear.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, the Reichstag fire in 33, which took civil liberties and cemented a lot of power, isn't that openly known to be a false flag event at this point?
It's highly suspected, but it's never been 100% proven.
Well, I'll say it then. It's a false flag event. And I suspect World War I's events that led in were also staged. But, I mean, are we looking at irony here? 1933, this all starts to come. And by the way, Hermann Göring in Prussia, our whole education system is related to the Prussian way they did it. But there's a problem with all these mainstream narratives. As I referenced in my last blog, a Mossad agent in disguise went on 60 Minutes and said, "We own the stage. The world is the stage we own, and we create a fake reality. We are the stage managers. We are the actors. We control this thing." So if all this is true, how can the premier intelligence agency in the world be the race that was supposedly targeted by all this? I don't have the answers, but I know when things don't fit. And for someone to openly come on TV and say things like that, I mean, why aren't people up in arms? Why? I mean, I could ask a million whys, but the fact is it happened. You can look up the video, and this really begins to underscore the damage that was done with these world wars and the onset of these surveillance agencies.
Beginning in 1939 and raging until 1945, World War II sees multiple developments with intelligence agencies. In 1939, the United States had fragmented and underfunded intelligence capabilities, which relied on the Military Intelligence Division, the MID, and State Department, with little coordination. As Nazi Germany was conquering Europe and Japan expanding in Asia, President Franklin D. Roosevelt recognized the need for a centralized agency to gather intelligence and conduct unconventional warfare. In July of 1941, he created the Office of the Coordinator of Information, the COI, which would evolve into the OSS in June of 1942, though its foundational work began in 1941 under the leadership of William J. Wild Bill Donovan. Donovan was a decorated World War I veteran, as well as a lawyer with a flair for bold operations. Unlike Nazi Germany's Gestapo and SD of 1933, which focused on ideological repression, the OSS aimed to undermine Axis powers through espionage, sabotage, and support for resistance movements, operating globally from Europe to Southeast Asia. Its creation reflected America's shift from isolationism to active engagement in a total war. The OSS's operations in 1941 and beyond were diverse and innovative, combining traditional espionage with unconventional tactics. They were headquartered in Washington, D.C., and recruited an eclectic mix of agents, such as academics, journalists, soldiers, and even former criminals, who were trained in languages, sabotage, and propaganda.
Jason and I covered years ago how the universities, the key universities, had been co-opted. And of course, that's done through funding. The person who gives the money has the ability to tell you what you will study and what you won't study, or to shut you down or end your funding. And also, they're mentioning journalists here. But in 1939, we've got a president supposedly saying, "Hey, things are underfunded." Jason, do you remember the date on the Eisenhower? I always get it wrong. Is it in the 50s, the Eisenhower speech?
61.
So in basically 1940, they're underfunded. And by 61, the president of the United States is warning everyone that we're losing control and you should be concerned about this. But as you go through, every time we go through these agencies, like he'll say the COI, well, that's 369. What I forgot to mention is World War II started. Is this really feels to me where the occult started to creep in to these, whatever you want to call them, these alphabet agencies, as we call them now. This is openly talked about Germany, not so much on our side, but I'll remind everyone, the Pentagon is basically an occult symbol, isn't it?
In July of 1940, Britain establishes their Special Operations Executive, SOE, which was a clandestine organization created to conduct espionage, sabotage, and support resistance movements in Axis-occupied territories. Authorized by Prime Minister Winston Churchill with a mandate to set Europe ablaze, the SOE operated under the Ministry of Economic Warfare and played a vital role in undermining Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and their allies through unconventional warfare. The organization merged existing intelligence units, which included sections of MI6 and the War Office, to create a dedicated body for sabotage and subversion, which was distinct from MI5's domestic focus or MI6's traditional espionage. Churchill's vision was to weaken the Axis powers through guerrilla tactics, which was inspired by irregular warfare in conflicts like the Spanish Civil War. The SOE, which operated from Baker Street in London, recruited a diverse cadre, which included soldiers, linguists, engineers, and civilians, who underwent rigorous training in sabotage, espionage, and survival skills at secret facilities in Britain and Scotland. Unlike the OSS in the U.S. in 1941, which it partly inspired, the SOE prioritized direct action and resistance support, reflecting Britain's desperate need to disrupt the Nazis' control across the now-occupied Europe. It was led by figures like Hugh Dalton and Colin Gubbins. The SOE trained and deployed agents across Europe, North Africa, and Asia, and coordinated with local partisans to disrupt enemy operations. Its innovative methods and global reach marked a significant evolution in intelligence and covert operations, which was distinct from earlier systems that Britain used, like Room 40. The SOE's operations were wide-ranging and daring, and spanned from Norway to Southeast Asia, with a focus on occupied Europe. Agents were often parachuted into enemy territory and worked with resistance groups, such as the French Maquis, Polish Home Army, and Yugoslav Partisans, supplying weapons, explosives, and training to conduct sabotage missions. The SOE's impact was quite significant, although it did suffer from certain setbacks, but they contributed to Allied victories by weakening Axis infrastructure and morale. In France, SOE-trained resistance groups disrupted German supply lines before and during the 1944 D-Day invasion, which caused delays with German reinforcements aiding the success of the Normandy campaign.
Well, to get a flavor right out of the gate, SOE is what, 1965? That's a 9/11 encode, to say the least. I guess we have the flavor. But if I'm not mistaken, World War II seems to be more than just moving chess pieces. The infrastructure for these alphabet agencies, as we call them now, seems to be the training, the places, all of it being put in place everywhere. The question is, did they have where we are now in mind? Was the planning for what's happening now in their minds back then? And I kind of think it was. If I'm not mistaken, also, the CIA at one time was not supposed to do operations within our borders, and the FBI was. And I think we've seen many incidents where they do whatever the heck they want anywhere. As a matter of fact, they're making Hollywood movies all the time that show people operating where they're not supposed to be operating. My main point here is World War I kind of kicks off where the new era is going to head and chess pieces start moving. By the time we're at World War II, we got a president saying, hey, man, these places are out of control. You better watch out. And just after the war, there's infrastructure in place everywhere. And for my money, we've never been the same ever since.
The CIA is absolutely not supposed to, it's in their charter, do anything within the borders of the United States. but they just do it anyway.
Well, they seem to have an open budget, all the money they ever want, and they seem to have no oversight. And from what we've seen over the last decade, people seem in high places with power, supposed power, seem to get blackmailed and told what they're going to do. But also, if I'm not mistaken, the U.S. military is not supposed to operate within our borders. I would have to look that up more carefully to make that a concrete statement, but I'm always reminded of Waco, what happened there, because people were screaming, are those military assets operating inside the United States?
By 1942, World War II was reaching a critical juncture, with the Allies facing setbacks in Europe and the Atlantic. German U-boats threatened supply lines, and Nazi forces were advancing in North Africa and Russia. The Enigma machine, which was used by Germany for secure communications, encrypted messages with millions of possible combinations, posing a formidable challenge to Allied intelligence. Bletchley Park, which was located in Buckinghamshire and operational since 1939, became the epicenter of Britain's code-breaking efforts, expanding from a small team to thousands by 1942. Unlike the Special Operations Executive, which was focusing on sabotage and resistance, Bletchley Park's mission was purely analytical, aiming to decrypt German signals to reveal their strategic and tactical plans. The breakthrough in 1942, which was driven by Turing's development of the bomb, a machine that automated decryption, along with captured German codebooks, allowed Bletchley to read Enigma traffic regularly, which provided them with a decisive intelligence advantage. Bletchley Park's operations in 1942 were a significant triumph of intellectual and technological innovation, blending human ingenuity with early mechanical-based computing. The bomb was refined by 1942 and had been testing thousands of cipher combinations daily. Captured materials from U-boat U-559 in October of 1942 provided updated codebooks, which enabled decryption of naval Enigma traffic. Decoded messages, processed in huts like Hut 8 for naval intelligence, revealed U-boat positions, troop movements, and supply routes, which was shared securely with Allied commanders. The codename for all of this intelligence was Ultra, for Ultra Secret. Bletchley's scale and mechanization were revolutionary, though its secrecy, as it was known only to top officials, required careful management to avoid tipping off the Germans.
All right, I'll be blunt. This whole thing seems like a cover story. How many movies do we have kicking this around like a football? From Russia with Love has like the Enigma idea, that new Turing movie where actually the device itself and the seriousness of war is not what you should worry about. That poor man wasn't sexually oriented in the way they wanted him to, so they treated him badly. That's what we're supposed to look at. But here's my problem. My problem is, you're telling me back in the day, someone hadn't come up with ingenious ways to code things that couldn't be cracked? And even if the answer to that is no, they absolutely didn't, we got the other movie that tells us about the Navajo Wind Talkers. And if you think about it, there were very few people that knew the language. And when they talked, there's almost no chance anyone's ever going to be able to crack that. To me, this whole Enigma thing and all these stories were told about how hard it is to encode things, it seems like a front story to grab attention to me.
Now we move to 1943, which is considered a pivotal point for the Soviet Union, as the Red Army turned the tide against Nazi Germany, shifting the Eastern Front's momentum after the brutal Battle of Stalingrad in 1942 and 1943. The NKVD, which had been established in 1934 as a merger of the Cheka's security functions and broader state control, was tasked with securing the Soviet state amid total war. Beyond its infamous role in purges and Gulag administration, the NKVD's Foreign Intelligence Directorate, led by figures like Pavel Sudoplatov, conducted espionage against both enemies and allies. The NKVD prioritized human intelligence, HUMINT, infiltrating German high command, Allied planning circles, and resistance movements to gather critical data and manipulate outcomes. Its operations were driven by the need to defeat Germany, monitor Allied intentions, especially regarding a second front, and suppress internal threats like deserters or nationalist uprisings in occupied territories. The NKVD's operations in 1943 were extensive and multifaceted, leveraging a global network of agents, defectors, and sympathizers. In Axis territories, NKVD operatives, who were often embedded with partisan groups in Ukraine and Belarus, gathered intelligence on German troop movements and logistics, aiding Red Army offensives, like the Battle of Kursk. Agents like Nikolai Kuznetsov, posing as a German officer, assassinated Nazi officials and relayed strategic plans, which disrupted German operations. Against the Allies, the NKVD infiltrated British and American circles, notably through the Cambridge Five, who provided secrets on Western military plans and atomic research. The NKVD also monitored resistance movements in Poland and Yugoslavia, ensuring Soviet-aligned groups gained dominance. The NKVD's scope combined espionage, sabotage, and political manipulation with an efficient and effective ruthlessness that was rooted in its Cheka heritage.
So what do you do when you're going across accounts like this with all these pretty serious ideas, and then you find part of it that's connected to nonsense? Like in this case, where they're worried about someone leaking their nuke research. Well, nukes don't exist to this day, as described. So what does that tell us about the whole story? And this is where it becomes problematic. When I look at things like this, I almost wonder how much of all this that went on was testing, how far people would be willing to go, how much they would take before they deserted or, you know, fought back, all these things. And it reminds me of, again, the Winter Soldier. What's that little dude that's with the Red Skull guy, the genius scientist? He basically says, yeah, we tried to take over the world by force, but it turns out people fight back. And this is where we learned that we've got to get them to want to be taken over. And I think a lot of this public-facing stuff is just to waste our cycles and focus on things of no importance. That's my point of view. But to be fair, I know I'm a bit jaded.
During World War II, Japan's intelligence system was integral to its imperial ambitions across Asia and the Pacific, with the Kempeitai and naval intelligence serving distinct but overlapping functions. The Kempeitai had been established in 1881 and was expanded during the 1930s and functioned as a military police force akin to Nazi Germany's Gestapo. They enforced internal security, conducted counterintelligence, and suppressed dissent in Japan and occupied territories such as China, Korea, and Southeast Asia. By 1945, it numbered over 70,000 personnel and was notorious for brutal interrogations, mass executions, and oversight of prisoner of war camps where they targeted suspected spies, resistance fighters, and ethnic minorities. Naval intelligence, which was under the Imperial Japanese Navy's general staff, focused on SIGINT and espionage, intercepting Allied communications and gathering data on enemy fleets, particularly the U.S. Navy. In 1945, this intelligence apparatus unraveled as the war turned decisively against Japan. The Kempeitai maintained internal control until the end, suppressing anti-war sentiment and monitoring civilians amid growing shortages and Allied bombings. However, its effectiveness waned as Japan's military collapsed, with key defeats like Leyte Gulf in 1944 and Iwo Jima in 1945 straining resources while Allied advances disrupted operations in their occupied territories. Naval intelligence, once adept at tracking U.S. Pacific movements, was crippled by 1945 due to broken codes and loss of key bases, failing to anticipate Allied strategies like the island-hopping campaign, Japan's surrender on August 15th, which was formalized aboard the USS Missouri on September 2nd, led to the immediate disbandment of both units under Allied occupation. The Kempeitai was dissolved by October of 1945, and its leaders were tried for war crimes at the Tokyo trials. Naval intelligence records were seized or destroyed, marking a total collapse. This had profound implications, signaling the end of Japan's militarized intelligence model and its imperial ambitions.
This is the same problem over and over and over. What I have been made aware of Pearl Harbor, turns it into a false flag perpetrated by us. If that's true, then everything we just heard is just more cover stories. And if you're not willing to consider that, which I am more than willing to consider because of the way it was laid down in front of me, there's the other story that Japan actually lost because they were running out of resources and oil, which isn't that hard to believe. It's a tiny little island. But the whole Pearl Harbor thing, everything that we're going to read is contingent on we got attacked. And this is so bad. Matter of fact, it's so bad, I don't know how much of it I can even delve into if it's going to run anywhere. But I suspect the Paul McCartney song, what is it, Jason? Hands Across the Water. Do you know the name of the song?
I'm familiar with it. I don't know if that's the actual title.
Uncle Albert, you know, the Admiral. I suspect that song may be a poke in the eye by people who actually know what happened. If I'm able at some point, I may get an account if I can get permission to put it out. But the idea, the basic idea, is that it was staged. And I don't have any trouble with that. I've covered this before, how TCM, the Turner Classics movie, every time around when you're supposed to remember World War II, they run World War II movies. Well, they were running propaganda films, which were not labeled as propaganda. They were labeled, oh, this is John Ford in real combat. Well, when you go listen to it, it is so shocking. There's a grandmother's voice in the back saying, oh, please save those kids. And I'm not even kidding. It's hard to imagine that the emotions were high enough for people to accept that when you listen to it now. But there's not a shred of combat. Then there's the movie that is also propaganda and now labeled as that, but it didn't used to be, run on TCM, that shows Pearl Harbor, supposed real film taken as Pearl Harbor's happening. Well, those planes are not Japanese planes. They're American planes painted as zeros. Not a single bomb is dropped. There's already detonation things put in the ground for the filming of it. Why do you need to do any of that if the story is as the story is presented? And, you know, I'm sad to say, this is all a put up, and it appears that the entire modern era has been a put up.
The end of World War II in 1945 left the United States as a global superpower, but its intelligence apparatus was ill-equipped for the emerging Cold War, which would be characterized by ideological rivalry with the Soviet Union and complex geopolitical shifts. The OSS, which had been created in 1941, had excelled in espionage, sabotage, and resistance support. But President Harry S. Truman, who was wary of a peacetime Gestapo and pressured by bureaucratic rivals like the FBI and State Department, dissolved it in October of 1945. Recognizing the need for coordinated intelligence to monitor Soviet intentions and global threats, President Truman established the CIG, the Central Intelligence Group, as a transitional body to coordinate foreign intelligence in January of 1946 via executive order under the National Intelligence Authority. The CIG was led by Rear Admiral Sidney Sowers and was tasked with synthesizing foreign intelligence from military and civilian sources, operating as a bridge between the OSS's dissolution and the CIA's formalization. Unlike Japan's Kempeitai collapse in 1945, which ended military intelligence, the CIG represented continuity, absorbing OSS personnel and expertise to meet new challenges. The CIG's operations in 1946 were modest but foundational, focusing on centralizing intelligence analysis and collection to overcome the pre-war disarray of agencies like the Military Intelligence Division. It was based in Washington, D.C., and employed former OSS agents diplomats, and analysts, gathering data on Soviet military capabilities, European reconstruction, and emerging communist movements in Asia and Latin America. The CIG conducted limited human through overseas stations, leveraging OSS networks in Europe, and analyzed open source materials. Its primary role was coordination, producing daily intelligence summaries for President Truman, and as a precursor to the CIA's President's Daily Brief. The CIG's brief existence culminated in the National Security Act of 1947, which transformed it into the CIA, an independent agency under the newly formed National Security Council, which was signed into law in September of 1947. The act formalized the CIA's mandate to coordinate foreign intelligence, conduct covert operations, and advise policymakers.
Woe to everybody everywhere, 1947, if these numbers are true. But the story is such a put up when you start to scrutinize things that I start to look at the whole ball of wax like this. What was going on before World War II? Well, we had the Vatican. That's been around a long time. They're in control of all religious concerns. And as we know now, so much of the banking. And we had the City of London, but maybe during World War II, it became more consolidated and there was more power because there was massive debt put on Germany and other places. So it consolidated into that money power city-state. But what was new? The new thing was us. We became the place where the city-state Washington, D.C. was the muscle of the world. So the trifecta was now in place. We got the Vatican handling supposedly the religious concerns of the world. As we know, they hold the paper, probably down to your birth certificate. And we have the banking center in the City of London, the second city-state, where you find all the obelisks from Egypt, of course. And now, because of all this, you've got a CIA and you've got a city-state that is basically the muscle. And as we have seen, what does it do? It becomes the police for the world. I mean, what do you think about all that, Jason, looking at it from that level?
Oh, there's definitely no doubt that the CIA manipulates things all over the world. Absolutely no doubt at all.
What do you think about the idea that, you know, we know these big wars happen to move the chess pieces, but that trifecta was put in place, and that trifecta pretty much runs everything everywhere at this point?
That is the suspicion by a lot of people who seem to know what they're talking about.
I mean, I'm just saying, it's hard to look at the minutiae that are put in front of us, because when you scrutinize, you come to things, well, wait a minute, if this was a false flag, this is all poppycock. Oh, wait a minute, here's the nuclear idea. Well, we know something about that too.
The end of World War II in 1945 left Great Britain navigating what could be called a new world order, as its empire was waning and the Soviet Union emerging as a rather formidable rival. The dissolution of wartime structures required a permanent British agency to address Cold War challenges, such as Soviet military expansion and nuclear ambitions. In 1946, the Government Code and Cipher School, GC&CS, Bletchley's parent organization, was renamed GCHQ and restructured to consolidate SIGINT operations, officially launching in 1947. The GCHQ focused exclusively on SIGINT, intercepting radio, telegraph, and early electronic communications to provide intelligence to MI5, MI6, and the government. GCHQ's operations in 1947 were shaped by the technological and geopolitical shifts of the early Cold War. Operating from sites like Eastcote and later Cheltenham, GCHQ employed former Bletchley codebreakers, mathematicians, and engineers to intercept Soviet communications, targeting military signals, diplomatic cables, and espionage networks. It used advanced radio receivers and early computers, building on Bletchley's Colossus, to process intercepted data, though its capabilities were rudimentary compared to modern systems. GCHQ's early successes included decrypting Soviet military traffic, aided by the 1946 UK-USA agreement with the US, which established a SIGINT sharing partnership that grew to include Canada, Australia, and New Zealand known as the Five Eyes. One hidden purpose of the Five Eyes Alliance was to circumvent domestic privacy laws. For example, Britain could spy on Americans, and the U.S. could spy on Britons, then share the data, allowing governments to access information they might otherwise be legally barred from collecting themselves. Compared to the Soviet NKVD's human focus in 1943, GCHQ's technical approach prioritized electronic surveillance, avoiding the repression of agencies like the Gestapo, and its collaboration with allies set a precedent for multinational intelligence cooperation. The impact of GCHQ's consolidation in 1947 was foundational, establishing Britain as a SIGINT leader and helping to shape Cold War intelligence.
You know what all this makes me wonder? You start reading how they're circumventing. Did any of these organizations ever care about the supposed country that they were supposed to be protecting? And by the way, this SIGINT, or however it's said, these are the very countries under the crown now that are suffering under the surveillance state. They get in there much quicker in places like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And look, this is probably where it all started. It's almost unbelievable. But as you read through things like this, you realize if there were Americans trying to crack the Russian codes, they had to have Russian speakers. And that's not an easy thing to do. But consider where we are now with AI. Do you suppose anyone anywhere, when AI comes to full maturity, anyone anywhere will ever be able to have a code that can't be broken? They're opening a can of worms that I think they're going to regret.
The late 1940s saw the Cold War intensifying due to events like the Soviet Union's 1949 nuclear test, the Berlin blockade in 1948-1949, and the Chinese Communist victory under Mao Zedong, which heightened global fears of communist expansion. Australia, being a key member of the British Commonwealth and a Pacific ally of the U.S., faced domestic concerns about communist infiltration, particularly within trade unions and political groups, as well as external threats from Soviet espionage and regional instability in Southeast Asia. Revelations regarding Soviet spy rings, which were uncovered through Britain's GCHQ and the U.S.'s Venona decrypts, alarmed Australian leaders and prompted Prime Minister Ben Chifley to establish the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, the ASIO, in March of 1949 to protect national security. A second intelligence organization, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, the ASIS, which was created secretly in 1952, but with preparatory steps having been made in 1949, was formalized under the Department of External Affairs to gather foreign intelligence, reflecting Australia's growing regional ambitions. Both the ASIO and ASIS emphasized human and counterintelligence tailored to Australia's unique geopolitical position. The establishment of ASIO and ASIS had a profound impact, solidifying Australia's role in Western intelligence and enhancing its security posture.
I mean, so we spent all this time being afraid of communism, and we just got done ensuring that China, which is communist, is going to be the world power. In 1997, they gave them all the tech. We covered that in Silicon Valley, which allows them to run all their social ratings and everything else. That was given to them. They're supposedly leading the world in AI. I thought we didn't like communism. We have endless stories of, oh my God, the communists are coming. And what about the whole Hollywood blacklist? That public-facing skit on the world stage. So we hate communism, but we're going to ensure that the biggest communists in the world are going to be number one. And by the way, we're currently headed, everyone, everywhere, towards some weird technical communism, whatever that ends up getting called. It's a bit much to take, isn't it, Jason?
Well, the computers are going to rule everything if we just keep letting them do what they're doing.
I mean, if they're going to say story after story, we've heard them. Oh, the communists are infiltrating and we're going to blacklist you and we're going to interrogate you. Have you ever been a communist? And yet I know for a fact that China was beat down and our State Department forced the new power over there to let the communists back at the table. So they saved it then. And now we, not too long ago, got done shipping everything that's made in this country over to there. All of our stuff is made there. We ensured that a communist nation is going to be a superpower, basically. And if you haven't looked around, we're all about to be communist, technical communists, if they get their way. It's all a play. It's all a stage act. And all these things that are public facing, I can no longer take seriously.
It seems like the dastardly plans that the controllers have in mind are first test bedded in China.
There you go. I am with you. I think when they gave them the tech in 97 in Silicon Valley, and anyone who wants that complete story can go back and listen to our episode on it. Rose will tell you, or grab Shoshana Zuboff's book called Surveillance Capitalism. And the whole story is laid out how they came to a picnic and were handed the tech that does their version of Facebook, which runs everything everywhere and is hooked into the social ratings and everything. We did that. Prior to that, the communist forces had been stomped down. Was it Chiang Kai-shek? I don't remember. I think it might be Chiang Kai-shek. I hope I don't get that wrong. But our State Department forced them to bring the communists back to the table to keep them alive. It's all been an act and a shell game, making the villain the very system that looks like it may be implemented if what we're covering here gets its way. All right, that brings us to the top of hour one. We've got so much more to get through, and this is really concerning if you consider where we are now and how we got here and how few people are even in the slightest concerned about the data collection. And it's interesting to me because people ask me about it and I talk with people and it doesn't matter what I say. They just really don't care that their data is being collected. And I don't even really have a way to communicate the power that that is giving these places. It's crazy. Anyhow, hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums and comments sections. They can create top-level ideas, and they can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, which covers all my older telescope work. It's got all the lunar waves that I shot, plus a couple. It's got the discovery of the second sun near the end of the film, and it has a litany of what I'll just call UFOs to include the invisible vortex shot in full spectrum and the baffling shooting orb. To this day, I don't know what that is. Members get exclusive access to my solar work now, and I was able to film today for 3 hours. That will be coming out before long. And I'd like to see everyone logged in as a member. So hope to see you there. I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
is the enemy of knowing.